Welcome to Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. This time, Robert Pinsky. Pinsky is the author of seven collections of poetry and served as Poet Laureate of the United States from 1997 to 2000. His work has been widely anthologized, and Pinsky has written, edited, or otherwise contributed to over a dozen other collections and or books about poetry. Some critics regard Pinsky as the last of the civic or public poets. During his tenure as Poet Laureate, Pinsky founded the Favorite Poem Project, which invited ordinary Americans to name their favorite poems and read them for a permanent audio archive at the Library of Congress. In addition to his acclaimed poetry collections, Pinsky has been praised by critics for his 1994 English translation of Dante's Inferno. Now, from the 2000-2001 season of Portland Arts and Lectures, here is Robert Pinsky speaking in front of a live audience at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall.
Thanks very much for the welcome and for the nice introduction. Winters, my teacher at Stanford, Carrie alluded to, was kind of a bully. And I can remember talking to him about that fight, and I can remember him saying, Liston's going to make mincemeat out of clay. He had taught boxing himself. I didn't really know that much about boxing, but I didn't like my beloved teacher's autocracy. So in a sort of twerp way, I said, well, I think Clay's going to beat him, not really knowing that much about it. And and he was an autocrat, so all the other people in the class also went, Imagine my feelings after the fight. Imagine how eager I was to get to class. And I did come into class, and I said, so, Professor Winters, did you watch the fight?
He said, all the experts were wrong. Proves that I'm an expert.
I learned something about authority. I'll try to pick up from the quotation of Carey's where I spoke of the medium of poetry being a human body, not words, not lines, not sounds. And I'll try to elaborate on that idea for you, to explain how it's related to this project, the Favorite Poem Project, and I'll even try a bit to put it into context of American culture and American history, if that's not too pretentious. The word medium maybe could use a gloss. The news media, each medium, newspaper, television, radio, it's a nice mind game to try to figure out why that same word is used for the spirit medium, who says, you know, person who goes into a kind of a trance, is,
it's Uncle Charlie. I put the newspaper behind the money. No.
And indeed, it is related to what we say when we say something is neither good nor bad. It's just a medium. These words are related. It was not that long ago, it was like 10 or 15 years ago, I realized that they're also related to immediate. We say do something immediately. These are all the same word. And the idea is, in each case, something that comes between. Something's medium, it's between very good and very bad. It's just medium. The news media come between the event, the information, and the person who receives the information about the event. The spirit medium comes between the other world and this world. And as I realized in a kind of little dawn or lightning flash at some point in my life, when one says, do it immediately, that means with nothing intervening, nothing coming in between. Im, as in immodest or improper, is a negative prefix. So to do something immediately is to do it without a medium. And I do believe that the medium for a poem is the reader's breath. There are cultural and indeed, I'll dare to say, political implications to that proposition. We live in a very, very beautiful and successful mass culture. I do not mean to deprecate it or to criticize it. Some of it is brilliant. Most of it is ordinary and uninteresting. Some of it is amazingly bad. That is also true of poetry written by highbrows such as myself. And the poetry that appears in sophisticated magazines. Some of it is brilliant and excellent. Most of it is ordinary and only mildly interesting. Some of it is amazingly bad. That's Pinsky's proportion. Most things that most people do, there's a little that's very, very good, a lot that's sort of okay, and a little that's really startlingly bad. So I do not come before you to tell you that poetry is superior to what you can buy on a DVD or a compact disc or what you see on TV or listen to or see on MTV. But there is a crucial difference. I once was writing an essay, and in the essay I said, poetry is perhaps the most bodily of all the arts. Some of my friends who read the essay in manuscript said, this is interesting. You know, Robert, dancing, dance, it's quite bodily. Yes and no. In dance, as we think of it as a high art, it's an art. The body in question is an expert's body. It is the artist's body. If I'm right about poetry, the medium for a poem is the audience's body, which gives it a special physical intimacy. It is not at the core of the art, is not Sir John Gielgud reading the poem in a beautiful, sensitive voice, or a wonderful actor performing the poem, as Gielgud was, or a skilled rap artist or performer, or the poet with a wonderful personality and giving you herself or himself, but anyone at all. Not necessarily an expert. Anyone who chooses to say, further in summer than the birds, pathetic from the grass, a minor nation celebrates its unobtrusive mass. Whoever says the words is the medium. In relation to this mass culture, that is so tremendously successful and impressive. And I like it. I like my television set very much. I like my computer. I like my CD player. DVDs can do beautiful things. But each of those media, the thing that becomes between the audience and the emotions and feelings of the artist who created the work. In each case, that medium is inherently and by its nature on a mass scale. An image of someone dancing and singing can be sent digitally, press a button, a million copies go out to Chile, Tanzania, Antarctica, Brussels, wherever. Nor could you go anywhere and see that performance. It is partly created digitally, which is not to say it's bad. I'm not saying that it's bad. It is on a mass scale. You may have noticed that I have not used the expression popular art or popular culture. I find that that term very often is used as a misnomer incorrectly. For mass art. Popular art, I would think, comes from the populace, comes from people. Mass art, even when it's very, very good, is created by experts, marketed and distributed by experts. It is on a mass scale. I believe that the human craving for art is bottomless and tremendous. So I don't think that poetry or any other art is threatened by the presence of other arts. Our appetite for diversion and difficulty and entertainment and challenge, we just all day long. Same person might get up in the morning, have a favorite classical music tune that wakes the person up on a CD, listens to a little bit of it, and then gets dressed to popular music, and then reads a magazine on the bus into work, and then at lunchtime is subjected to some other thing in her car where somebody takes them, and then in the evening reads a poem and then watches TV. It's not an impossible thing for me to picture. The numbers of works of art that we come in contact with, and then all the other things we invent and that are like works of art, like this little work that each of us makes in the morning to present ourselves, and the houses, domestic architecture, all these are part of the human impulse to decorate, to ornament, to make. In that craving, which I believe is universal, in that craving, I believe we need, want, desire, works or an art that is on an individual scale, on a human scale. And it seems to me a crucial necessity, particularly in a democracy where the notion of equality is important, and in a country where, if we are a people, and we're a nation, a great nation, our cultural products, our political power, our economic power, we're a nation. But if we are a people, let alone a great people, we are not a people by blood. There is no American blood. We are a people by shared memory. We are a people by shared memory. And if that memory is only on a mass scale, something is missing and defective. Now, there are cultures, and I'll stop again to say that I'm not making a judgment. There are cultures where certain arts like poetry are cared for by certain sources. One of these sources would be, related to the idea of blood, it would be a unifying single folk culture, so that the grandmas and grandpas tell the jokes, recipes, stories, songs, poems to the children in a domestic setting. And poetry is part of that folk heritage. We are not one folk. The African-American grandma and the Italian-American grandma and the Yankee-American grandma and the Korean-American grandma and the Japanese-American grandma and the Jewish-American grandma and the Armenian-American grandma are likely to have different stories they tell. And it's not as simple as that diagram, because the grandmas are likely to be sort of Korean and sort of Jewish in this country, quite conceivably. So we don't have the curatorial function of the folk culture. The other great source of caretaking for art is a social class, an aristocracy, or a high bourgeoisie, let's say, that considers itself by heredity the caretaker of art, so that there are countries where there is a snob value, to put it simply, to poetry and art. Some Americans can't believe it, but yes, there are countries where the politicians need to at least pretend to love the great national poet, or they would be scorned. This is true. And they get a few lines by heart. I am not saying it's better or worse, but it's different. In Latin America, in a lot of Eastern European countries, and in parts of Eastern Europe, if a driver is angry at another driver, he yells at him, "You have no culture." I submit to you that this is not an American insult. We find other things to say. This does not make them superior or inferior to us. There's a time when Americans used to sentimentalize the poetry readings in the Soviet era, when there were 40,000 people or 60,000 people went to a stadium to hear an event that was sponsored and promoted by official organs. Even the degree of naughtiness or protest that had in it was calculated by experts. And maybe there was some good writing there, but it was as if Microsoft or Coca-Cola decided to have a poet. That was the power of the government, and they were exploiting a tradition of this snob value, aristocratic value, that was associated with the art. The notion that the art of poetry doesn't need equipment, doesn't need mass reproduction, doesn't need a skilled performer, doesn't need the presence of the poet, is for me an important notion about our culture. Curatorship is an important question in our culture. Duke Ellington should be remembered. Buster Keaton should be remembered. In my opinion, they were great artists. They were mass culture in their time. Because of the roots of Keaton's comedy in vaudeville and the roots of Ellington's music and things like the blues, they were even, in a way, popular culture. Their memory is now taken care of by universities, film societies, jazz societies, the National Endowment for the Arts. So rapid and so dynamic is our culture that things that were popular culture quickly need caretaking. We improvise ways to do this caretaking. We make them up. We found the film society. The university decides to have jazz studies or film studies. We're always trying to catch up. I have found, as a result of this poet laureate title, I talked to reporters. Reporters love to ask you this question. It's amazing. It's as though it's the question. It's so irresistible to them. What about poetry slams and rap music? What about poetry slams and rap music? I don't know. There are various things to say about it. Some of it's probably pretty good. Most of it's innocuous. A little of it's really awful. My friend Yusuf Komunyaka says that what disturbs him in some rap music is that it's marketed rage. Takes the idea of black rage and says, this is like toothpaste. This is a commodity. We can sell this. We have the demographics of the people who like to buy it. And he finds that disturbing. Some of it seems kind of, I must say, I heard this, the kid that everybody is so mad about, and this is making all this money, he's kind of smart. But the reason they like asking the question is that it's part of show business. It's performative. And the culture is very impressive and powerful and monolithic. This other thing is on an individual level. And I sometimes feel allied with some of the styles kids make up. Like, it may be fading now, but for a long time kids were very interested in putting a staple through their nose, or kind of a spike through the scalp, and all of that. I can understand it as a way to do something that Macy's won't be selling to 11-year-olds in a few weeks. Because things like breakdancing and rap music are popular culture for about 6 weeks, and then the scouts for the corporations incorporate it, and they make it mass culture. Maybe there's a circulation, though. Sampling, in a way, represents a circulation. That then it gets made individual again. A metaphor I like is the steel oil drum. What is a more unpromising object or product of our economic system? A steel oil drum. It gets rusty. It's not that pretty to start with. It's this squat, utilitarian, hard to dispose of, dirty thing. People found a way to make music out of it. In fact, they invented a whole new kind of music made of it. And I hope, for me that's a metaphor of a lot of things to do with mass culture, I hope that when it became then somebody at a record company, we can make money out of this. This too can become a commodity. I hope some of the people who invented it made a little money out of it. And I presume that somebody somewhere is sampling some of it back down into something else that comes from this human scale. The Favorite Poem Project was based on this notion that reporters do come to gradually. Sometimes they see the light. It was based actually on two notions. It was based on that notion that Kerry referred to in the introduction, that poetry is a vocal art, a bodily art, and not necessarily the body of an artist. It's the body of whoever wants to say the poem. And the other notion was that, contrary to the stereotype of the United States of America, and for reasons I've tried to sketch, we don't have the unifying folk culture, we don't have the aristocratic social class, and we have the very powerful mass art. For those reasons, the great attachment to poetry on the part of many Americans, completely outside any professional microcosm of poetry, is hard to see and requires curatorship. It requires someone to notice it. So I invited Americans to write to me, tell me the title and author of a poem they loved, and to say a few sentences about why that particular poem was of particular importance. We had an advertising budget of about $40. We stopped at 18,000 letters and emails because CNN was about to do a story on us, Life magazine was about to do a story about it, and the staff of this thing consisted of a few graduate student slaves at Boston University. So we cut it off then. We were opening up it again on the website at favoritepoem.org. And the letters were very impressive to me. Imagine getting a letter, someone says, "My mother taught me this poem when I was young. I got it by heart. She asked me to recite it to her as she was dying, so I did." Imagine getting a letter, and we had several along these lines, where someone says, "On the second date, my husband and I discovered that we both had this poem by heart. I think that's the moment when we fell in love." My original idea was that because of the vocal nature of the art, we would make audio tape recordings of these people. And I thought that since the Laureate's office is in Washington and a lot of people come through Washington, we could tape tourists from all over the country. And fortunately, the National Endowment for the Arts and the Millennium Council at the White House gave us a grant to make videos. The terms of our grant was to do a portrait of the United States of America through the medium of poetry in the year 2000. So we did shoot 50 videos. I think they're quite extraordinary. Some of you have seen them. We show them on the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer from time to time. And if you have Real Player, you can go to favoritepoem.org, O-R-G, favoritepoem.org, and you can see them. I urge you to watch John Doherty read Walt Whitman. In his letter to us, he describes himself as a ditch digger. And in the video, you see him in his hard hat digging a ditch. He works for Boston Gas. And then he looks at the camera and he talks about Whitman and reads Whitman, sitting on a sort of earth mover. He reads some Whitman. I urge you to watch a young man named Seth Rodney read Sylvia Plath.
You're listening to poet Robert Pinsky speaking in Portland in 2001. This is Literary Arts, the Archive Project, and more from Pinsky is coming up. This is Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor. This time it's poet Robert Pinsky. Here he is again speaking at the Arlene Schitzer Concert Hall in Portland.
I'm going to read to you a bit from this anthology that also came out of the project, Americans' Favorite Poems. Before I do, I should tell you that we had certain goals with this project. One was to have as wide a range as possible geographically, regional accents, ethnicities, ages, must have some children, must have some very old people, wide range of professions, kinds of education. And it was also clear very early in the idea that it should not be all American poetry, because there are many Americans who love poems in Italian, Yiddish, French, Navajo, Korean, Greek, ancient and modern, etc., etc. Sometimes because of their family background, sometimes because of something they studied in school, as in the many Americans who love poems by people like Rilke, Neruda, Miwosh, either in translation or in their original language. There have been about 1,000 favorite poem readings around the country. I urge you to have one here. You could, in Iowa, we had the mayor of Iowa and the governor of Iowa each read a poem, along with some school kids of different races, a Vietnamese immigrant who wore Vietnamese national dress and chanted the poem, Vietnamese. We've had a few very successful ones at Town Hall in New York. One, we had school kids, a lot of Hispanic school kids from the Bronx, along with Ed Bradley of 60 Minutes, Suzanne Vega, Laurie Anderson, Jimmy Breslin. Jimmy Breslin reading Yeats in his Queen's accent. Tining and tining in the widening gyre. The falcon, can I hear the falconer? He claims that his uncle or grandfather, somebody in his family who was a politician in Queens, used to give Jack Yeats, Yeats's father, walking around money. And imagine Arthur Schlesinger Jr. reading a town hall, reading a poem, and then being followed by a man who was an adult literacy student, as I learned how to read at the age of 40. What you would discover if you got somebody from the, say, a firefighter or a police officer, someone from city government or county government, some high school kids, maybe one or two kids from grammar school, a doctor, a businessman, a janitor, whoever, you had the 14 people up there, you would, and I think they should be up here, you would see an interesting phenomenon. You would watch each of them listening to the others. And it creates a certain atmosphere. It's related to, but not the same as, the way a group is drawn together if someone in the group has a talent, as though someone just were to stand up in a group of people and sing, or tell stories, or dance, or play an instrument, or draw in some way that we all loved. We would feel more a group. We'd be brought together by it. This is not that. None of these people are experts. None of them are artists, particularly. But each of them is doing that other thing where sometimes in a group somebody says, I would like to show you my treasure. This is my treasure. Sorry. And we have sunk extremely low as people. Things are in a very, very bad state. If we do not, when someone shows us their treasure, if we do not show, in a word, respect. It's like when somebody shows you a picture of their grandchild or their dog. You say, oh, what a cute dog. Or, or things have gotten very bad. And this is showing a treasure not like this, but in one's own voice. Present it in your voice. And you see people, I can remember in Atlanta, the first reader, or one of the first readers was, I think he's in the book, I know he's in one of the videos, guy who works at the post office in Atlanta, just Atlanta Historical Center, and he reads a very angry 70s Amiri Baraka political rap, And he sort of frames it by saying, this isn't how I feel. When I first read it, I hated it. I'm still angry at it, but it identifies a certain thing. He sort of separated himself from it, but it was that powerful. Next person to get up is in the book, Nancy Nersesian. She says, my brother was one of the youngest people ever commissioned an officer in the United States Army. He was a very funny, very intelligent young man. When he was just commissioned, he went to Vietnam and had 11 months of almost constant combat. And when he returned, his family and friends gradually realized he would never be a whole person. Then she reads that little Akhmatova poem, an Akhmatova poem in translation, that says, I have a lot to do today. I have to get used to grief. I have to get lost to sorrow. I have to realize that some things are just completely lost. She sits down. Then an 11-year-old boy stands up. He talks about the Atlanta Braves and reads Casey at the Bat. Then a woman who's a Supreme Court justice in the Georgia Supreme Court stands up. She says, I'm rather young. I'm a woman. I'm African-American, and I'm a Supreme Court justice in Georgia. A lot of pressure is involved with this. She reads from Alice Walker, For My People. Then a lawyer recites Elizabeth Bishop from memory, et cetera, et cetera. You can see them watching one another and their family and friends and sort of constituencies listening. And afterwards, they're talking to one another so animatedly because they're all in the same boat. They're not experts. And for me, this is one of the things that culture does. And with all due respect for performance, which can be great, electrifying, wonderful, and mass art, there is something in art on an individual scale. I recognize, by the way, that there is a paradox that these are videos, and they now do appear on television, on the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer. Each of them, I think you will agree if you see them, each of them also shows what I'm talking about better than I can by describing it to you. You see it come out of a person. I'll read to you from the book. The book, by the way, I heartily recommend this book. It combines the interest of poetry and the interest of gossip, because each poem is accompanied by quotations from letters that we received about the poem. I'll read. The contents page reflects the kind of eclecticism of Americans and their tastes. It's alphabetical. Akhmatova, Ammons, Archilochus, Arnold, Ashbery, Atwood, Auden, Amiri, Baraka, Bishop, Black Elk, Blake, Boland, Bradstreet, Brooke, Brooks, Browning, Burgos, Burns, Byron, Carroll, Cather, Catullus, Cavafy, Solon, Chaucer, Cisneros, Clifton, Coleridge. Here's a letter from Marianne Witte, 55, social worker, Detroit, Michigan. She wrote, for the last 22 years, I have lived in an inner city neighborhood, working through the church for social and economic justice and racial reconciliation. As a young woman, I admired this poem. Only now that I am older do I realize what really good advice it is, in addition to the beauty of its music. I've deliberately read the letter first, so you can try to guess to yourself what a 55-year-old social worker working for economic justice and racial reconciliation, what poem she chose. The poem is by Archilochus, the Greek poet, written in the 7th century B.C. Very short, and a wonderful translation by Kenneth Rexroth. This is the poem she chose in Rexroth's translation. Will lost in a sea of trouble. Will, lost in a sea of troubles, rise. Save yourself from the whirlpool of the enemies of willing. Courage exposes ambushes. Steadfastness destroys enemies. Keep your victories hidden. Do not sulk over defeat. Accept good. Bend before evil. Learn the rhythm which binds all men. I like the way those abrupt little courage exposes ambushes, keep your victories hidden. Those short things are set up by that Save yourself from the whirlpool of the enemies of willing. That sort of box inside a box, like a Russian doll of those prepositions, sets the other thing up. I think it's awfully good. And what she says about it, for me, reflects my notions about poetry. She says she loved the beauty of the rhythms of the poem. Only later does she realize it's good advice. The art must begin with a physical encounter, as all attachments and affections do. A lot of well-meaning teaching of poetry has given people the idea that a poem is an occasion or challenge to see if you can say something smart. I have no objection to smart things. I approve of them. I prefer them to stupid things. But that's not what a poem is. A poem is something that's moving and exciting and sounds terrific when you say it out loud. You will analyze your friends and family and interpret them for the rest of your life. That is not how you became attached to them. It's a physical presence. If you like a cuisine, a sport, a city, a family, a country, a house, it's a physical encounter that begins that. So if there are teachers here, or if anybody wonders what, how I think people should teach poetry, the teacher must teach works the teacher loves. The teacher must read aloud to the students, and the students must read aloud to one another. Her poem that she chose ends, "Learn the rhythm which binds all men." I suppose I start with and like it and choose it from the many poems in this book, partly because that's sort of what I'm talking about. There's a way we're connected to one another through art, and to be connected to one another through an art that is inherently and by its nature on an individual and human scale has an important place, has a valued place. You can see why I have a sort of despairing chuckle every time somebody says, well, what about poetry slams and rap music? It's fine, it's great, but it's not this. Something a little different from this. Maybe they overlap too. Sometimes many letters appeared about one poem. I'll read two more poems to you from this book. I'm proud to say this book is now in its sixth printing. Norton has yet to do it in a paperback because they keep selling the hardcovers. This is a poem by Robert Hayden, the first black American to hold the post that became poet laureate. I'll read you the letters and then the very short poem, and then I'll finish with another poem. First letter I'll read you, Manly Johnson, 78, retired. I stoked the furnace at the address in Ann Arbor where Hayden and I lived. The poem he wrote later about his father recalls to me the discomfort and regrets of that time. Peter Fringle, 33, high school teacher. When I first read this poem, I was immediately struck by the relationship the speaker has with his father, as it reminds me of the way my stepfather and I related during my youth. He was tough, had been a Marine, a football coach, and had been raised by an aloof, disapproving father himself. Not once in my life did he initiate an embrace or say he loves me. I used to resent this lack of warmth and his inability to express emotion or compassion. The last stanza of Hayden's poem opened up my heart to the ways my dad did show his love for me and still does. Healing wisdom is the true purpose of poetry. People don't always agree. He says healing wisdom is the true purpose of poetry. Wilmer Potter, 75, wrote, "Until I read Hayden's poem with its awful conclusion, I had not tried to understand my father's severity and let go of my subterranean anger. I thank the poet for that." John Clark, 54, legislative researcher, Chevy Chase, Maryland. "I first heard this poem about 20 years ago when I started working at the Library of Congress and Robert Hayden read at a gathering of poetry consultants. The poem really struck me then and has haunted me ever since. It was around the time my son was born, but it reminds me of the relationship between my grandfather and my father and also somewhat of the relationship between my father and myself. My grandfather was an Irish immigrant who was a widower at an early age and raised six boys. My father was the oldest. I guess my grandfather, my uncles have told me, had to be particularly hard, even though he was very loving toward my father. My father later became a police lieutenant in New York City And although they're from an Irish-American background, and Robert Hayden grew up in an African-American background, at these deep human levels, the particulars don't matter. My father and Robert Hayden were almost exact contemporaries. They were born and died within about a year of each other, 1912 and 1913, and 1980 and 1982. And the last letter that I'll quote to you, Phyllis Becker from Kansas City, six words. How would you like to write something and have somebody say these six words about it? Broke my heart and restored it. Those Winter Sundays by Robert Hayden. Those Winter Sundays. Sundays, too, my father got up early and put his clothes on in the blue-black cold, then with cracked hands that ached from labor and the weekday weather made banked fires blaze. No one ever thanked him. I'd wake and hear the cold splintering, breaking. When the rooms were warm, he'd call, and slowly I would rise and dress, fearing the chronic angers of that house, speaking indifferently to him who had driven out the cold and polished my good shoes as well. What did I know? What did I know of love's austere and lonely offices? What did I know? What did I know of love's austere and lonely offices? Isn't offices, that cold word, a wonderful word to end on? Sometimes you want to touch somebody in the heart, you use an icicle. Love's cold. Ah, terrific. I'll close with a poem that I might have chosen myself. People say, what would you choose? I never asked anybody to give the one favorite poem. Just a favorite poem, and along with Keats's Ode to a Nightingale and Ben Jonson's To Heaven and At the Fish Houses by Elizabeth Bishop and Further in Summer Than the Birds by Emily Dickinson, I might have chosen this one. It's just so great. It's so beautiful to read aloud. And it starts out seeming to be a bizarrely ballad-like poem about one woman. I say bizarrely, partly because the ballad is very hyper, very, very ballady. And ballad is a kind of community form. It's like that unifying folk culture I said we don't have. And she's so isolated. And then the poem turns out to be spoken by a town. And as the letter, it's one of the few anonymous letters in the book, because this it's person's identification with the poem is complicated and dark. As the letter says, the poem is partly about the way an extraordinary individual gives a community dignity. You know, Oedipus lived here, or Lear. We gossip about this person and makes us more important. But also the person becomes elevated somehow by the fact that her tragedy is noticed by a community. And the first person plural comes into the poem. The poem is by Edwin Arlington Robinson. I think it's one of the great American poems written at the beginning of this century. Not enough people know it. The woman in the poem has to choose. She has to choose between, on the one hand, a love affair that she knows is just going to be a disaster. It will be very bad for her. Or, on the other hand, no love affair at all. Guess which one she chooses. Eros Tyrannos means love the tyrant, love the boss, love the king. And I think what I'll do is just, I'm eager to deal with your questions. I think what I'll do is simply read this poem to you and make it the closing part of these more formal remarks of the evening. She fears him and will always ask what fated her to choose him. She meets in his engaging mask all reasons to refuse him. But what she meets and what she fears are less than are the downward years drawn slowly to the foamless weirs of age, were she to lose him. Between a blurred sagacity that once had power to sound him, and love that will not let him be the Judas that she found him, her pride assuages her almost, as if it were alone the cost. He sees that he will not be lost and waits and looks around him. A sense of ocean and old trees envelops and allures him. Tradition, touching all he sees, beguiles and reassures him, and all her doubts of what he says are dimmed with what she knows of days, till even prejudice delays and fades, and she secures him. The falling leaf inaugurates the reign of her confusion. The pounding wave reverberates the dirge of her illusion. And home, where passion lived and died, becomes a place where she can hide, while all the town and harborside vibrate with her seclusion. We tell you, tapping on our brows, the story as it should be, as if the story of a house were told or ever could be. We'll have no kindly veil between her visions and those we have seen, as if we guessed what hers have been, or what they are, or would be. Meanwhile, we do no harm, for they that with the god have striven, not hearing much of what we say, take what the god has given, though like waves breaking it may be, or like a changed familiar tree, or like a stairway to the sea where down the blind are driven. Thank you. This is all questions? Oh, these are the sort of sit-up questions. These are the questions that are meant to please me. I'll accept the one that invites me to read a poem of my own. It specifies a poem. The question is, will you read Shirt? The answer, I'll answer in my native language, New Jersey. Yeah, sure. Shirt. The back, the yoke, the yardage, lapped seams, the nearly invisible stitches along the collar turned in a sweatshop by Koreans or Malaysians gossiping over tea and noodles on their break, or talking money or politics, while one fitted this arm piece with its overseam to the band of cuff I button at my wrist. The presser, the cutter, the ringer, the mangle, the needle, the union, the treadle, the bobbin, the code, the infamous blaze at the Triangle Factory in 1911. 146 died in the flames on the ninth floor. No hydrants, no fire escapes. The witness in a building across the street who watched how a young man helped a girl to step up to the windowsill, then held her out away from the masonry wall and let her drop. And then another, as if he were helping them up to enter a streetcar and not eternity. A third, before he dropped her, put her arms around his neck and kissed him. Then he held her into space and dropped her. Almost at once, he stepped to the sill himself. His jacket flared and fluttered up from his shirt as he came down, air filling up the legs of his gray trousers. Like Hart Crane's bedlamite, shrill shirt ballooning. Wonderful how the pattern matches perfectly across the placket and over the twin bar-tacked corners of both pockets, like a strict rhyme or a major chord. Prints, plaids, checks, houndstooth, tattersall, madras. The clan tartans invented by mill owners inspired by the hoax of Ossian to control their savage Scottish workers, tamed by a fabricated heraldry. MacGregor, Bailey, McMartin. The kilt devised for workers to wear among the dusty clattering looms. Weavers, carders, spinners, the loader, the docker, the navvy, the planter, the picker, the sorter sweating at her machine in a litter of cotton as slaves in calico head rags sweated in fields. George Herbert, your descendant is a black lady in South Carolina. Her name is Irma, and she inspected my shirt. Its color and fit and feel and its clean smell have satisfied both her and me. We have culled its cost and quality down to the buttons of simulated bone, the buttonholes, the sizing, the facing, the characters printed in black on neckband and tail, the shape, the label, the labor, the color, the shade, the shirt.
That was Robert Pinsky speaking at the Arlene Stutzer Concert Hall in Portland in 2001. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear this or any other talk in the series, visit literary-arts.org. Spencer Raymond produces the Archive Project for radio and podcast. Special thanks to the Literary Arts staff, board, and community, without whom this show would not be possible. And thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.